I'm John Krall. Spring is the season when things begin to bloom and gardeners get that gleam in their eyes. Today on No Limits, we will talk about spring yard and gardening tips, about the ways you can make your lawn more beautiful and your garden grow. We'll also talk about the threats to trees, plants, and flowers, and what you can do to combat them. We'll discuss all of this with our guests, Cliff Sadoff of the Purdue Entomology Department, David Forsell of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Kara Daffhorn, an urban gardener, blogger, and the owner of You Relish Farm. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. We are talking today about spring yard and gardening tips here on No Limits. We're fortunate to have as our guests Cliff Sadoff, who is with the Purdue Entomology Department. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. We also are fortunate to have with us David Forsell, who is the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful. David?
Hello.
Good to have you here.
It's very nice to be here.
Good to see you again. And Kara Daffhorn, who is an urban gardener, blogger, and the owner of the You Relish Farm. Kara, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I need to confess to the audience up front here, I know nothing about gardening. So this hour-long exercise really is going to be an exercise in informing someone from a tabula rasa position here. And I'm going to start, you know, if there are people out there like me who might have some interest and wanted to start gardening, I'll start just by asking, how should you begin in the most simple way? I'll start with you, Kara.
Great. I love to believe in the edible landscape, so okay. I like to think of shrubbery as the first place to start, thinking about currants and gooseberries and elderberries, things that take up space that we might have an option for, like a boxwood. So think shrubbery as a first place to start.
Think shrubbery as a, and what should you do with the shrubbery when presuming you have gotten it? Where would you go about getting it and getting started?
Well, shrubbery can be purchased at a natural store, any big box store. You might couple it with the concept of having a patch of permaculture. A patch of permaculture is simply plants that are perennial, that are ever growing and never have to be reseeded. You can buy any of these at a natural garden center.
Okay. Cliff Sadoff, how would you recommend that you get started if you just want to get started gardening?
Start small, think big. The best thing to do is to start off with a positive experience, something that you can manage. It might just be a few lettuce seeds, something that doesn't get eaten by too many insects, and watch it grow and harvest your first salad and then move on from there.
Okay, and David Forsell, what would you recommend, especially since I would think you'd be talking also, making recommendations about urban gardening as well?
Yeah, I think these are both excellent ideas. And I think the other piece, from an urban and community gardening standpoint, is find some great resources to help you get started. Purdue Extension is a wonderful place to begin work. They have great resources. There are so many folks doing community gardening right now. KIB is another resource that can sort of, point you in the right direction. And then from a personal standpoint, I love the idea of shrubs and trees because Shannon and I at home, we don't raise any.
Shannon, I presume, is your...
My lovely wife, okay. Yes. She and I don't grow vegetables, but what we want to do is to create a place that supports wildlife. And so when I think about a garden, I think about what are the native trees, what are the native shrubs and plants that we can do that ultimately support wildlife, whether it's, food or shelter, that sort of thing.
We are talking about spring yard and gardening tips here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Okay, I'm going to take a step back from this, and I'd like to get some sense of the satisfaction that you draw from gardening. I'll start, stay with David on this one and then work back around. You were talking about how you wanted to have a place where you can preserve wildlife or make it welcoming. What is it that speaks to you about working in the garden and working outdoors?
So many different things. So the first image that came to mind for me is that, you know, we've been pretty intentional about planting for butterflies and planting for birds. And so each summer at our home, we've planted some very common butterfly bush, very common, native, we sat out one morning with our cup of coffee and our butterfly book, and we counted 9 different species of butterflies on 3 shrubs in a matter of 1 hour. And it's beautiful, and you just get a sense that ultimately you're contributing to something larger than yourself. And it's just such a great feeling. Plus, it smells good. So it is a sensory experience. It can very much be a values experience about...
What do you mean by that, values experience?
A values experience, meaning, you know, how shall I wish to live? Gardening often can be a wonderful vehicle about expressing and executing the values that you have. So for Shannon and me, we want very much to support biodiversity and to have joy in our living space. Mm-hmm. And be surrounded by nature, and gardening is a wonderful way to do that.
Kara, I want to reframe that question ever so slightly with you, because clearly this goes beyond, you know, for many people, gardening is a hobby, it's relaxation or whatever. In your case, it became a lifestyle and to some degree a career, too. Did it start as hobby and relaxation, or was this something you always wanted to do, and why?
Mine's a lemon to lemonade story.
Okay.
I was released in 2008 from my full-time career of 17 years.
What were you before you became?
I was a development director for Indiana University Foundation.
Okay.
And working for the IU School of Medicine at the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences.
Okay.
Which had a division of nutrition and dietetics.
Okay.
And so I had this great opportunity to regenerate myself and be in the sunshine all day long. And so for 3 years, I gardened. And so my story is just one that small is possible, and that you can go from a garden scenario right to market. I'm currently employed as an owner of a business, and I really think it's a success story that you can take 0.36 acres and go to the city market and open up a consuming local-based product that gives you pleasure from growing.
And Cliff Sadoff, I'm going to ask you, what prompted your interest? I mean, obviously, yours also goes beyond the hobby and recreation. It's a professional.
I'm an entomologist by profession, so I'm involved in trying to keep the bugs from eating the different things in the garden. And you know, my specialty is on things you don't eat. But I guess I started gardening when my mom gave me some vegetable seeds and told me to get lost for a couple hours in the backyard. And that was it. And I started gardening.
And playing around with it.
Yeah.
Well, and I will say this, and again, I want to emphasize to our audience, who is welcome to join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, that, you know, my skills at gardening are worse than rudimentary. They're non-existent. And to the point where if you put me out there, I'm sure I would manage to rip up every flower and leave every weed, not out of malice, but surely simply out of incompetence. So I ask this question based on people like such as myself or others who are out there who don't know, you know, quite what they want to do, have some interest in it. You know, what are the common mistakes that people make when they decide to garden? And I'll start with you on that one, Kara Daffhorn.
I think we don't test our soil enough, and we can ask for help in getting our soil tested, especially if we're in an urban environment. We need to check our soil so that we don't put any contaminants in the food that we've just had the pleasure of growing and then consuming. So that's where I'd begin, is check your soil.
And how do you go about doing that?
Any Department of Health, whatever county you live in, would have a soil sample test kit that you can request online.
Okay, and they will send it to you, and then what is the process like for test? Do you just take some of the dirt and then you send it off to them, presumably?
Correct.
Okay, so we'd start with the idea of first you test your soil. What are some of the other common mistakes that people make? David Frisell.
Well, putting stuff in the wrong place, that's a big one, especially even, I think, particularly with trees. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to, without a bit of knowledge or just even some knowledge, modest knowledge, to do the wrong thing. So, you know, I learned the hard way when I was new at this stuff. I planted trees right up against my house and, you know, mm-hmm. became, you know, very aware of when utility crews would go through and make a mark on the trees that were on my property because they were under power lines where people had put trees in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. And so I think really understanding the space you're planting in, the trees, their size at maturity, and making sure you're making the right decision on the front end before making your purchase and digging that hole.
Where should the trees go? I mean, if presumably we've already established, I think, in the conversation, not right under a power line. That's a bad place. Okay.
I agree.
Not up against the house. So what sort of space ideally would you want?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to achieve. So, you know, for instance, if you're interested in an environmental perspective and how it is that you plant trees for functionality, you plant trees on certain sides of the home, for instance, to create shade, mm-hmm. Which can help reduce your utility costs. You may want to plant trees to create a wind buffer if you're out on some land and have a little breeze now and then. So it's really about what you're trying to achieve with your plants. Mm-hmm. We all at our house, we've planted for wildlife. We've planted to create a beautiful sort of buffer between us, mm-hmm. And an alley behind our home. And we've planted a wonderful tree right outside our window because we wanted more views close up to nature out of all of our windows in our home. So it depends what you're trying to achieve, I think.
And the two big places, though, obviously not to do this, are under the power lines and close to the house. What are the other common mistakes, Cliff? Sadoff.
Yes. Well, one of the things you might want to be thinking about is whether or not you would be willing to use any insecticides or any fungicides to protect your tree. So, and if you'd rather not do that, then you want to stay away from trees that get lots of problems. And a good example of that would be crab apples. Crab apple trees are beautiful flowering trees. You go to your nursery, you'll buy the kind you want based on the leaf color, based on the flower color. But you should also look to see if it's resistant to a defoliating disease called apple scab. And there are others that are resistant to a defoliator called the Japanese beetle. And I think we all know the Japanese beetle is that green and copper beetle that comes and swarms in June and July, or maybe this year, maybe as early as late May. So do you plant resistant plants when at all possible?
Well, and I do want to get to the issue really of some of the threats that are out there right mm-hmm. now in just a moment. But I thought I'd ask real quickly, what's the best time of year to plant trees? I mean, is there a particularly good time? Cliff, I'll stay with you.
Oh, I'll yield to the guy who plants a lot more trees.
All right, David Frisell.
Well,
David Frisell. Love
planting in the fall. I mean, I think fall in many ways is a better time to plant than in the spring. In that the roots are the most probably important thing about caring for those roots and giving those roots a chance. And so fall enables trees to get their roots established and not have to deal with drought and hot temperatures, as opposed to planting in spring. Everybody has the urge in spring, but there are some challenges with planting in spring that you may not have to deal with if you plant in the fall. Summer, we sure don't recommend planting trees. It's just not a good time to be doing it.
We're gonna talk more about trees in just a moment. We are talking today here on No Limits about spring yard and gardening trips with our guests, Cliff Sadoff, the Purdue Entomology Department, David Forsell, who's president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Kara Daffhorn, who is an urban gardener, blogger, and manager of You Relish Farm. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. We're talking today about spring yard and gardening tips with our guests, Cliff Sadoff, Purdue Entomology Department professor, David Forsell, who's the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Kara Daffhorn, who's an urban gardener, blogger, and the manager of You Relish Farm. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to talk now about what seems to be a pretty persistent threat out there, and that is the emerald ash borer. And first, let's talk a little bit about what it is and then how we deal with it. We'll start with that first part. Cliff Sadoff.
Okay. The emerald ash borer is a beetle that came here from East Asia in 1993 into Detroit, and was first discovered in Indiana in 2004. It was imported into Indianapolis on a planting in Hazeldale Parkway. Okay, so that's sort of the epicenter of this area over here. And what this beetle does...
How do we know all of that?
Well, there have been a lot of people following it.
I'm just curious as an intellectual thing, because it's not like it's an insect, so it wouldn't have been keeping a flight plan or anything like that.
So, yeah. You know, that's actually kind of funny, because I spent so much time working with people whose job it is to track that bug. It's an invasive species.
Yeah.
And invasive species get a lot of attention, it's one of the consequences of importing a lot of goods from all around the world on solid wood packing material. They use cheap wood to bring it to keep stuff from falling over in ships. And then what they wind up doing is that they'll open up a container and bugs will fly out because they were using cheap wood. But then after 1998, then President Clinton signed an executive order making it illegal to use wood pallets that were made out of wood that was not kiln dried.
Okay.
So now
it's harder for the
insects to come here. So the thing is that there's a whole USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, commonly known as APHIS. They their job is to track invaders. Mm-hmm. And when it comes into the state, they contact Purdue, the state specialist, and I get involved in trying to help them contain it. So that's why I kind of know these dates.
Oh yeah, no, I'm fascinated about is that we have that level of scrutiny.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I took you off point here.
Yeah. So the point of it is that this is a beetle that feeds underneath the bark of the tree, and it cuts off its circulation, and it basically dries it out and kills it. Right now, the beetles that are in the metropolitan area are concentrated on the northeast side. They started in Hazeldale Parkway. Castleton Mall is kind of shot, that whole northeast corner shot, and it's moving its way, perking its way down almost to downtown Indy. Matter of fact, we were talking about whether or not the trees in the parking lot were infested, so we'll take a look afterwards. So at any rate, so this beetle right now is underneath the bark, getting ready to make to become an adult, changing from a larva to a pupa to become an adult. The adults start flying when the black locusts bloom. Normally, that occurs in mid-May. That could occur any time now because it's been very, very, very warm. They'll come out. They'll chew on the leaves. Then they'll mate. Then they'll lay some eggs on the surface of the bark. Then they'll bore into the trunk, and they'll start girdling, which means feeding under the trunk. And they'll be starting to kill the trees.
And how long a process is this? If you've got them, is it just ash trees?
Fortunately, it's only ash trees. That's the good news. The bad news is that there's lots of ash trees.
Yeah.
And it turned out that the cities, after the elms were killed, put in a lot of ash trees. So a lot of the big ash trees we have here were replacement from elms. Mm-hmm. So in the 1990s, ash trees were consistently on the street tree of the year. Autumn purple white ash is a beautiful ash tree. And there are loads of these things downtown here. So about in Indiana, we have anywhere between 10 to 40% of the street trees being ash trees. So it's a huge problem. And so it takes about, once it really starts rolling, it takes about 2 to 3 years to kill a tree. The way I like to look at it is that the proportion of trees that are affected by emerald ash borer will double every year. So if you start at 1% and you double it every year, by 8 years, you will lose all your trees. And typically we start noticing that the ash trees are present, are being attacked when we have 1 in 12 of the ash trees, or about 8% of the trees being affected. And that means you only have 4 or 5 years. So if you're seeing trees at most, so if you see if you start seeing ash trees in your neighborhood dying, you're just starting it, you got 4 or 5 years till they're all dead, unless you do something to protect your trees.
And what can you do to protect
your
trees?
You can use insecticides. There are three types of insecticides that can be used. That homeowners can use it. It's available. The product is called imidacloprid. Oh, and by the way, we have a website at Purdue called eabindiana.info, eabindiana.info, where you can get all your information. So if you think I'm mumbling these names, you can sort of read them yourself. Okay.
EAB.info is for everyone out there, www.eab.info.
Yeah. Okay, so imidacloprid can be bought in a hardware store. It's sold either as a Bayer tree and shrub, or there's Fertilome. It's a Fertilome product. There's a number of products that are out there. It has 1.47% or 2.9% imidacloprid in there. You could apply that to the base of your tree and protect a tree that is up to 20 inches wide at chest height.
Okay.
Okay. And do that every spring.
Okay.
Bigger than that, you're going to have to use some other products. Such as triage, which is an injection where the tree is actually injected with an insecticide. And we know we can protect trees up to 20 inches in diameter, but we also know that the trees can definitely be helped even far larger. The data is still coming in on that sort of stuff. But if you have a very large tree, I would use the triage product. The triage product works very well on trees that are already showing signs. They can protect trees that are up to half dead.
So it's not just an inoculation. It can, in effect, be a cure, too.
Okay. It's not this is not like a polio shot.
Okay.
It's a poison that kills bugs.
Okay. Yeah. So should you wait to see if there are signs, actually, that you have the emerald ash borer, or should you do it as a preventative thing?
I would do it as a preventative because, and I'm not sure exactly where the listening area is, but if emerald ash borer has been found in your county, and you can find that at our eabindiana.info site, you should start treating your trees and start protecting your trees, because it's a lot. Because the way all this insecticide gets into the trees is it goes in either through the soil or it goes into the trunk through the vascular system and up into the leaves. Then when the beetle feeds on the leaves, it dies before it can lay eggs. And if you have part of your vascular system cut off and there's no juice getting up in there, the beetle won't see the insecticide.
And I probably should ask, because there may be people who actually like bugs out there too, that these beetles, do they perform any other function other than killing trees? Is there other value in terms of the...
Well, the most beneficial thing that I can think of is they keep me employed.
Okay, well, so in that case, they do have an economic value.
Yeah, for me, and I think they're putting a lot of the children of many people in the tree care industry through college.
Okay,
but other than that, no, they're a real pest. They're close cousins of another borer called the bronze birch borer that you might remember that attacks your birch trees.
Okay. We are talking about spring gardening and yard tips here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Three questions.
Sure.
If we have time for them very quickly. A really, really bad thing, foliar nematodes in hostas. I'm just wondering what the latest is on that, if anybody cares besides me and everybody else in the Hosta Society here. But the latest is that you sort of can't get rid of them. They're in the soil forever. They can even winter over in the dirt that's attached to a rake or something like that. They're difficult.
So I'll tell you what. Stay on the line for a second rather than taking all of the questions. We'll take this one. I'm going to toss it to Cliff Sadoff real quickly. Cliff?
All right. I think you're on the right track, but unfortunately the exact details of that sort of elude my memory at this point in time. But I like everything else, when you have something that is in the soil, and I do believe that these things move around in the splash water. So during heavy rains and such, that when they'll splash around, they can move from plant to plant. You definitely would like to rotate out your plant. I don't know how long you would have to take your hostas out before you can put your hostas back in there. I also know that there were some insecticides, and I can't remember the name of them at this point in time, that when applied could actually slow down the progress of this, but I just don't really remember the names of the materials offhand.
And is there a way that Elizabeth could either get in touch with you or go to get the information?
Yes, if you would go to Purdue University and look under the Extension web page, there's something called Ag Answers. You can do a search, and we'll get back to you with specifics on that question.
Great. And your next question, Elizabeth.
Okay, is another biggie. Fig buttercup. The scientific name has the word ranunculus in it, and I don't remember the rest of it. But this thing is, I think it's been described as an annual, a winter annual. It's part of its problem is that it has slightly waxy leaves, so I think they're resistant to a lot of herbicides. And also they have little waxy nutlets at the bottom. I'm wondering what chemicals can eradicate those forever? And, or what if we used preen next fall and used that as a pre-emergent, even though they're not seeds, they're nutlets?
Okay.
Once again, as an entomologist.
Yes. Go ahead, Cliff.
Yeah.
Cliff,
once again, as an entomologist, this is a little bit out of my area over here, but it sounds to me like you have a perennial weed that also produces seeds, okay? Mm-hmm. Not that much different from a dandelion, okay? Or yellow nutsedge, okay? So you mentioned this little nutlet. You're right, it's in the buttercup family. So the approach for this is what you want to do is you want to kill the tops of those weeds on a regular basis, and what that does is it reduces its capacity to produce nutlets, that keeps it persistent. There are probably some other herbicides that could also reduce nutlet production. I don't think that the nutlet would be killed by something like preen, because that would be a pre-emergent, I think, acts on the on the plants that are coming out of seeds and not necessarily these nutlets. But once again, go to that Purdue website for more details.
And I'm going to ask David and Kara, since you both garden as well, to pull you into this. When you run into a problem like this, where do you guys go for information?
I go to my 94-year-old mentor.
Who's your 90? You give him a plug.
Well, they have it's a her.
Okay.
Linda Crosley up in Madison County, and she has 100 acres. And so she's kind of seen it all, done it all, and I asked for help.
Okay. And David, who do you call?
I have the very good fortune of being a friend of Joellen Myers Sharp, who, amongst many folks, is
I worked
very
with
well
Joellen
known
for years at the Star.
Yes.
Great soul.
So she's just a wonderful lady and very knowledgeable on these matters. And I think Hoosier Gardener might be part of her email and website, and she's just a wonderful resource.
And one more question, Elizabeth, and then we're going to let you go, okay?
Okay, violets. How does one get rid of those?
Violets, any
in the lawn?
Any tips there, folks?
Broadleaf herbicides are available at your local nursery and the hardware store. And the way that they're probably, I'm not sure exactly which ones are being used at this point in time, but I know that you can get a mix, and that will take care of it. I think that timing is the issue for that one over there. And, go to Joellen Myers Sharp column. She's a great person and has a lot of information. Look up and see what Purdue has over there. I have a hard time answering this question because I actually don't mow my violets because I like them.
That's what I was going to say.
That's your problem, too.
They're
okay,
so invasive. And
I know.
For lawn nutrients. Well, and they're like little umbrellas shading out. Never mind.
We have
I don't like them.
Okay, well, Elizabeth, thank you very much for the call and for the questions. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, or you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Tracy, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How about you?
Pretty good.
Your question, please.
I have a question. I'm a local artist, and I do paintings. And I've been painting on dead red elm trees that are still standing. I've been taking them, cutting them down, dissecting them into just basically slicing them up, mm-hmm. and then painting colorful circles on the wood. Mm-hmm. I call it my tree ring series.
Yeah.
And basically, I was wondering if there's an all-natural way to just to make sure that there's no bugs in the wood before I would sell these and people would put them in their homes.
Oh, so that we're not transporting the good question. And Cliff Sadoff, sounds like a natural for you.
Well,
thanks for the call, Tracy.
Sure. Thanks, Tracy. You can either cook it or freeze it. Okay, so what I'd recommend that you do, so when you say you're cutting these, you're making these circles on these trees, are these stumps or are these blocks of wood that are separated from the ground?
Actually, he's off the line.
Okay,
now.
All right. If these thank you. If these yeah. trees are wood that are made, the wood comes from the trees. I would take the wood and I would put it in an oven. At maybe 250 degrees for about an hour or so till it got nice and hot and the core temperature got, you know, nice and warm inside there. And then that would do a great job at killing the bugs that are inside there. And then you could paint and you'd be safe. If you were doing this in the middle of the summer mm-hmm. and you got your tree when all your insects are not prepared for winter at all, throw it in the freezer for about a week. And that'll...
And then once you thaw it out, presumably... And
then you'll be fine, yeah.
And I wanted to ask a question real quickly about the emerald ash borer. Sure. I presume, do these things, part of the problem, the reason they're difficult to contain is that they fly from tree to tree, or is there, how do they migrate? Or
the beetles fly from tree to tree, and they move, they can fly up to a half a mile, okay, to find a new tree. And they're very hard to find because they're tiny little green insects about the size of a penny that live up in the green canopy with all the leaves. So they're hard to find, and the other thing which is also difficult is that people don't really have a concept of what an ash tree is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, everybody thinks of maple trees like the Toronto maple leaves,
mm-hmm.
or an oak tree is this big sturdy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows what an ash tree looks like, and the way people know what an ash tree looks like in northeastern Indianapolis is they know, oh, those are the dead trees. Okay.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do, and we've been working, you know, with David at KIB for a while, we're developing this program called Neighbors Against Bad Bugs.
Yeah.
And the whole idea is we want people to act now, save trees, and save money in developing a response plan to the emerald ash borers. And the way it works is like this. We have these green tags and purple ribbons, and you don't necessarily need our green tags or purple ribbons, but we get people who know what ash trees look like, and we get them to tag trees in neighborhoods. So then what happens is that people see all these tagged trees, and they want to know what's wrong with the trees. And we say, well, these are ash trees, and they're all going to be killed when emerald ash borer comes. And now, you know, David and I can work on this together because we are sort of public service entities. And and we're just trying to educate folks. Landscapers have problems because people think they're just trying to make money.
Yes. We are talking about spring yard and gardening tips here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. I'm talking with Cliff Sadoff, the Purdue Entomology Department, David Forsell with Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Kara Daffron, who is an urban gardener, blogger, and owner of You Relish Farm. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the State House File, and your host. We are talking today about spring yard and gardening tips. We're fortunate to have as our guests Cliff Sadoff, who is with the Purdue Entomology Department, David Forsell, who's the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful, and Kara Daffhorn, who's an urban gardener, blogger, and the owner of You Relish Farm. We've been getting a fair number of questions here by phone, and we've also gotten an email question that that I wanted to ask you guys. And if other listeners would like to send in email questions, the way to do that is to send it to nolimits@wfyi.org. This is from a listener named Linda who says, can you guys talk about composting? My boyfriend bought a giant composter for Christmas, and aside from throwing food waste into it, we're really not sure what to do with it. I'll start. How about with you, Kara? What would you... Do you compost? And if so, what is the value in it, and how would you recommend that they proceed?
I do compost. I do above ground composting and below ground composting. I think it's dependent upon the size of your garden.
Can you explain real quickly what the above ground, the below ground distinction, what sorts of things are involved there?
In my case, it might be a tumbler or a recycled trash container that's above ground versus a below ground, which is you dig a hole and you might use a hamper that has holes in it. That's a below ground kind of composting.
Okay. And what sort of things in terms of the question Linda's asking, what should they just be throwing food waste into it or other things?
I practice the lasagna gardening approach, which is a layers of composting. Might be hay material, might be hair cuttings. It might be food waste, such as what your juicer might have afterwards. I stay away from meats, bones, any product that isn't a vegetable matter in a small urban garden.
Why is that?
Because of bacteria. Principally, I stay with food waste that are going to break down quicker than a piece of carcass or a bone.
Mm-hmm. And I should say, David Forsell and Cliff, do you both compost as well? Or
yes,
you do.
We don't.
You don't. Okay. Mm-hmm. Tip, Cliff, what tips do you have to offer?
Well, I agree about not having the bones, but it's more of like especially in urban areas, you don't want rats coming in there, and that's. That's garbage with a capital G. But you know, it can be done. I am much more informal. I throw my stuff into a hole in the ground, and then what I do is, when we're doing spring renovation, is I'll just dig up the compost. That's I can tell because that's this nice earthy color, and I put that into my bedding in my flower garden, and I use that, and it just the plants grow better. Mm-hmm. It holds moisture better. It's just nicer to work with. The plants like it.
We are talking about spring yard and gardening tips here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, yes. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Certainly. Your question.
I'm wondering, we do have an ash tree that's affected by the ash borer, and we had an estimate of around $400 to treat the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that a person can do themselves, or do you recommend a professional?
Cliff okay. Sadoff, please.
Yes. It really depends on how big your tree is. When you're standing in front of your tree and you stick your arms out and you put your hands on both sides of the trunk, about how far apart are your hands?
I would say probably 18 inches, maybe 12 to 18 inches.
Okay. Is there any visible damage at this point in time?
There is.
There is.
We can see the little bore holes up high.
Okay.
With some missing bark, and there are a couple of dead limbs.
Okay.
Fairly large.
So is your tree leafed out just yet?
It has.
It has leafed out. Okay. So.
Yeah.
What proportion of your canopy, that would be the green part on top, what proportion of your canopy is brown and not leafed out?
I would probably say one-fifth of it is showing.
Okay.
You know, no green.
All right. Well, that would mean to me that, you know, that's pretty much on the borderline effectiveness for the do-it-yourself products. Okay, because the do-it-yourself products work up to 25%, And, you know, honestly, it's kind of early to tell the full extent of what the Emerald Ash Borer is doing at this point in time. So I would think that, you know, your 20, what looks like 20% might actually be 40%. So I would recommend a tree injection with a compound, with a product called Triage.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And that's going to be, depending on who you're talking to, I would always make sure you get at least three estimates. I know that there are prices anywhere ranging from $9 to $10. Dollars. Some people do eight, but anywhere from $8 to $20 per inch. You know, you want to make sure that you're working with somebody who's a certified arborist. You want to make sure that they have a Category 3A license. Go to
our
webpage.
Where would you go to look for all of that sort of stuff?
Go to our webpage, eabindiana.info. And we have a site called Frequently Asked Questions About Pesticides, and we made a YouTube video so you can see what it looks like when somebody actually injects your tree, and we have YouTube videos on how to do it yourself as well. So eabindiana.info, Frequently Asked Questions About Pesticides.
Okay, thank you. One more quick question.
Sure.
Our whole neighborhood is affected. We mm-hmm. live in Westfield, and we're not too far from, it sounds like, where it originated. Okay. And is it something like once you treat your tree, but your neighbor's tree, like can they fly back, or is it once it's treated,
yes.
it's treated?
Okay. You're going to have to protect this tree for as long as the beetles are flying in your neighborhood, okay? And the fact that you have some trees that are showing signs says that you're fairly well advanced into the situation. You probably have three, maybe four years tops before all the trees are dead. I would suggest that you and your neighbors get together and try and work and try to get a group discount.
Some economies of scale.
Economies of scale, yeah. And if you go onto our website, eabindiana.info, and look for Neighbors Against Bad Bugs, mm-hmm. which we can give you tips on how to organize and how to look for an arborist and how to get bids.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you so much for your help.
Certainly.
You.
Take care. Thanks. We've gotten a couple other callers who didn't want to go on the line with us, who have called in and asked, got a 20-year-old tulip tree that looks good on one side, but on the other looks like it's been machine gunned. What to do? And I'll toss that open to anyone who wants to take it. Cliff?
The first step is to look for a certified arborist to see if that tree is likely to fall down. I mean, that's the first thing. You know, when you see a tree which just looks like it's half dead, that tree could weigh several tons, like it could mm-hmm. weigh like two or three of your cars. Okay,
yeah.
And imagine a refrigerator falling into your bedroom window. Not a pretty sight. So
yeah.
Hire an arborist to assess the tree to see if it can fall down. Because if the tree is half dead, generally trees, you know, when wood dies, it's dead. It doesn't come back again.
Yeah.
So it's probably going to have to be removed, and get a professional to do it.
Well, and I want to ask real quickly, what are the signs that your tree is too far gone? I mean, it sounds like with the, you know, with EAB, that that there's a point where you do hit a point of no return
here.
Yeah,
well, when you want to think of it like this, the parts of the tree that are dead are never going to come back again.
Mm-hmm.
So just envision your tree with just the green parts left and ask yourself if that's something worth saving, worth shaping back into something that could be a nice-looking tree. And if it is, then you want to save it. And if you don't know what to do, hire a tree care professional. There's a website called treesaregood.com from the International Society of Arboriculture. They tell you all about how to find a local arborist.
We've gotten another question from a caller that I think probably speaks to Kara the most, and says, how to approach apartment gardening, especially concerning herbs. How would you get started if you have an apartment? What would you recommend?
I'd think about window box gardening. I think that gives you the senses and the pleasure of gardening, but in a very contained environment. She or he could look into the earth box as an option for the patio. Mm-hmm. And you also might consider the aero garden, which is an indoor hydroponic garden that can be placed on a counter in the kitchen.
David Forsell, what would you recommend if you wanted to start an apartment garden?
I would say that this is the expert we just heard from on that.
Okay.
I'm not sure I can add a whole lot. One thing I might want to add is related to the ash borer. Keeping Annapolis beautiful is often organizing volunteer projects to plant trees. And so we're going to be working with lots of neighbors and the city of Indianapolis on replacing trees, because people are going to notice the loss of all these trees. And so I just wanted to encourage folks to think about if they're in a community where the ash borer is hitting
is
them
a
pretty
problem,
hard.
Yeah. And it sounds like it could be all of us fairly soon.
Yeah, that we stand ready to do the best we can to help communities replant and reforest.
We've gotten an email question, comment from a listener named Jerry Zimmerman, who's with the Biology Department, University of Indianapolis, says, interesting program on insects and weeds. A couple of comments. I can understand the desire to control insect pests. However, it is very important to be judicious in the use of insecticides. Many of them are very harmful to honeybees and wild bees. Please use them carefully. Honeybees are not aggressive. Be kind to them. This is honeybee swarming season. If you see a swarm, please call a beekeeper, and gives the website indianabeekeeper.com. Bumblebees are quite beneficial. Late summer and fall, yellow jackets are often confused with honeybees. Try not to destroy white clover violets. This is speaking to you, Cliff, and even dandelions. I know I'm rowing upstream on this. They are very valuable to bees. Do we need to be aware of this and the balance of things?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, many of you know that there's been a lot of press about insecticide use in seed-treated corn. A lot of these insecticides are related to the materials, to the same products that are being used for ash trees to control emerald ash borer. It turns out that ash trees are wind-pollinated, mm-hmm. and they're not pollinated by bees. Okay, so because of that, the risk is not nearly as great as if it were for a maple. There was a study that came out last week where they were tracking bees that were flying in areas where they treated maple trees to kill Asian longhorn beetles with some of the same products. Mm-hmm. And they did find that it substantially disoriented bees and is likely to be contributed to this phenomenon called colony collapse disorder in that particular region at that particular time. So, rule of thumb, don't put an insecticide out on a flower mm-hmm. that's going to be visited by bees, because the bees pollinate your crops, and they're good. They're good guys, okay? Don't put a systemic on a plant just before it flowers, okay? Mm-hmm. So wait till after they flower before doing that, using these systemic insecticides. But really be mindful of bees.
And it sounds like this whole thing is far more complicated than it, which is part of the challenge, I would assume. Part of the reason that you enjoy it is that it's not something that's absolutely effortless. BB, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I had a question about the emerald ash borer again, going back to that.
Sure.
I had a very large four-story mature tree in my front yard that was gorgeous. I ended up having it cut down in the fall. It had some area of disease. I didn't think it was that bad, but as the summer went on, it just seemed to get worse. Probably about a quarter of the tree was dead, mm-hmm. and it was so big, and the branches were really big, you know, and I had it taken down. So, but I had a small tree in my yard as well that I had injected, and it wasn't showing any kind of signs of disease, but the arborist that I had out here said all of the trees have the borer, and they don't necessarily show it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe they did a 2-year injection, so I wanted to ask about that. But also, many of my neighbors have ash trees and haven't done anything. And some of them that looked dead at the end of last year have come back and flowered. And I wondered if that they're just tricking us, you know, or they, is it going to go downhill? Because now I'm regretting. I took down this absolutely gorgeous tree, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe, you know, could I have saved it? So.
Cliff Sadoff, can you give BB some comfort here?
Just real quickly. That tree was a goner, okay? And you took it down before the wind blew it down on your house or somebody who you care for. Okay, so that was a good thing. The second thing is that there are the injections, the triage injections do last for 2 years, and there's some recent data that shows they might even last up to 3 years on even smaller trees. But I think your arborist was telling you the truth, that these trees are very, the beetles are very hard to find when they're in low densities. I myself have been fooled many times thinking a tree was perfectly healthy and it died the following spring, and I declared it fine. So he's right, he or she.
Thank you very much for the call, Bibi.
Thank you.
Take care. We've gotten one other question here that I'd like to get to very quickly because we're running up on time. It's a tweet from a listener named Shannon. Says, sustainability is a new watchword. What's a good, simple start? Grow some of your own food. Start, support a good group. What would you recommend if you just want to start building David Forsell?
Gosh, I think the two things that come to mind for me first is planting a tree. Mm-hmm. And planting a tree with...
An ash tree or some other tree?
Planting something other than an ash tree, because okay. It provide you benefits, it'll provide wildlife benefits, and just it's a simple act that has so many benefits. Great way to start.
Kara Daffern.
Look to perennial herbs, thyme, rosemary, sage.
Oh, sounds like a Simon and Garfunkel song to me. Okay. And Cliff Sadoff.
Plant flowers.
Plant flowers? Any sort in particular that...
Perennial flowers, because they're easy. Once they're in the ground, they keep on coming, and they get more and more and more. The first year, they sleep. The second year, they creep. And the third year, they leap.
All right. And I should bring that back to David Forsell real quickly. Is there a particular kind of tree you would recommend?
Native trees.
Which give some examples.
All sorts of wonderful benefits. A variety of oaks, a variety of maples, just many examples.
I would really like to thank all of you for joining me. You have actually contributed not only to the audience's education, but my own. I've learned an awful lot just listening to you, and you've made it fascinating. I really appreciate it. I'd like to say thank you to my guests, Cliff Sadoff, who is with the Purdue Entomology Department. Cliff, it was a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you very much. David Forsell, who is the president of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful. David, it's always a pleasure
thank
to talk
you.
With you.
Thank you.
Thanks
you
much for coming here. And Kara Daffern, urban gardener, blogger, and owner of You Relish Farm. Sorry about that. Kara, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure was mine. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. We will be talking again next week. Take care, all.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.